woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SB Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 39. We had a kind of a very quiet day yesterday. Looks like maybe a quiet day today as well, so far, with all the negotiations going on in Washington. Not sure how they're going to pan out. I obviously, like most people, despite what looks like kind of a weird deal, whatever, if it ends the war, I'm all for it. We have Professor Carl.
Oh, you do.
You how are you, bud?
Well, you know, I woke up this morning, and in my email box was a very interesting thing.
From you won the lotto. You won the lotto.
Oh, God, no, I did not. Yeah, that would be an interesting thing to announce, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
I don't think I'd be announcing
that. No, I'm saying you might not want to announce that.
Well, I think if that happened, it'd just kind of like disappear off the grid, and you'd be like, hey, what happened to that guy?
What's the number you can win where they don't bug you? Where nobody will bug you? A couple hundred grand, maybe?
All of them in some states, including Tennessee, by state law, it's your identity is public. So you're... In some states, you don't have to do that. You can basically set up an LLC and have it claimed, in an other than your personal name. There's a yin and a yang to the argument on that. The yang is that you, for reasons of integrity of the game, you want people to be able to identify that the game's not rigged, and you know that's one of the ways you do that, right?
Well, there's this daily thing here that goes off twice a day, and once in a while it gets up to like 400,000 or 500,000, and I throw a couple bucks in there on a Sunday morning getting gas, and
right,
people win that all the time, and you never hear any of those people. I mean,
that'd
be fine with me. A couple hundred grand, nobody knows who it was. It's maybe cool. It's fine with me.
Well, I think the ones that obviously the ones that get people's attention is when it's $500 million or something like that,
which is crazy anyway. But
yeah, but here's the and it's the worst gamble anywhere.
Oh yeah,
even when the jackpot is huge. Mathematically, it's a terrible gamble on the money odds. You're far better off going to Vegas. But
just mathematically, without going too deep into it, there's two edges to that sword. One is your chance of winning is still horrendous, even if the thing is up there. But they also, if you let a whole bunch of weeks pile up, they do pay out more in that week than they take in. So from a gaming theory point of view, it actually is an okay deal.
No, it's not.
Well, I'm saying in some weird sense.
No, it's.
I mean, it's still the same for you. I get it.
Well, I'm saying it's a better bad deal, but it's. I mean, it's a less bad deal, but still a bad deal.
Right.
And then here's the other problem.
Well, that's what I'm kind of asking you to math, because they only pay out like 40%, so it's horrible.
But if
10 weeks pile up to where it's a $10 million winner in like Illinois' regular lotto, they're going to pay out $10 million that week. They're only going to take in $1 million that week.
Right. But the thing is that doesn't matter to you.
Right. It does not matter to you.
What matters to you is the money odds.
Right.
For every dollar you wager, what if it, assuming you win, okay, for every dollar you wager, what are the odds that you have to have before that becomes a decent gamble?
Well, what's okay? even more crooked is if the jackpot is 100 times more than normal, if you get like three numbers, it's the same number, which is even worse.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then the other thing that goes along with that is the winnings are taxable. So in terms of the actual outcome to you, you're putting a wager on the table with after-tax money, okay? So you play with your $2, and say you hit a $1 billion jackpot, all right? No, you hit a $500 million jackpot.
Not even, it's worse than that. They pay over 20 years.
Well, not if you take the cash. But you know, let's say you take the cash. Okay, so then you know, so it's 700. Say it's 700 million. It's well, like right now, I'm looking at the Powerball thing. It's 643 million over the 20 year annuity. The cash value is 290.
Then you got to pay tax on that.
So take half that off.
Yeah.
All right. So now that's the actual money odds.
Right.
And the problem is that even if the jackpot's a billion, those money odds are still deeply negative.
Without a doubt. Well, plus you still got to match six numbers, which is impossible to do.
Well, it's not impossible. It's right. I mean, you can sit there with the calculator if you don't believe their numbers, although they're accurate. I've checked them. Those are the odds.
What do you make of some people are saying now that if the same people win a lot because there's actually a pattern to the numbers?
So there's one of the things that they try very hard to do is, you know, with the ball machines and things like this, is eliminating that possibility. And you have to be a little careful here, because this is very similar to what happens, you know, in a casino, in that you walk past a roulette table and they all have that vertical bar out there, or you know, at the end of it, showing all the like the last 20 spins, what it came up with, right? Just because you had 10 blacks in a row does not mean
I hope everybody on the show knows that, but I sure do.
Well, I'm saying it doesn't mean that the next one's going to be one way or the other, okay? A true game of chance that is not rigged, whether intentionally or otherwise, that has absolutely no bearing on the next
thing. I'm saying, I don't know if you heard this, but this was about 3 months ago. We don't want to go too deeper into this because we got other stuff to talk about. But yeah. Somebody did something in Texas and I don't know, a couple other states.
Yeah.
And they found out that there's people who have won multiple times. Not the big one, but, you know, do pretty well.
Right.
Very seldom there's a person who wins. It's according to this guy now, that the people who win just go in and say, give me five lottos.
Right.
They all do their own numbers.
They're all playing in a set of numbers.
Yeah, right. And somehow or another, the people who have won four and five times claim that there's a pattern. And they, yep. And I don't know, who knows how the hell they know, but the thing that bothers me is we should go back and maybe Matt can find it. We had a show on maybe 12 years ago. Kind of when we first started, a guy wrote a book about how crooked the lottery is, especially in Illinois, and he was pretty fascinating. He wasn't talking about the ones you and I are talking about, the big ones, you know, the lotto, the whatever the games that go state to state. He was talking the scratch offs and how crooked they are.
I mean, if you can get any kind of inside information, then holy God.
Well, Kevin says that now they actually, if you go online, if there's, you know, 20,000 tickets in the Carl game with you know, 15 winners of 200 grand in there or something, Kevin claims you could go online and you can find out how many tickets are left and how many big winners are left.
Yeah, actually, that's true.
It wasn't always like that, and I'm not so sure.
Well, that's true. Like, I know it's true in Florida. I know it's true in Tennessee.
It wasn't always like that.
Right. Well, like Florida and Tennessee both have apps, and you can either go on their webpage or you can use the app, and it will tell you, you know, of this game, you know, this is game number 426. And of this game, there are five top prizes still out.
Yeah, so they didn't, okay. When this guy was on, evidently they didn't do that. And he said if people won all the prizes in the first, like, 20%, they still continued to sell tickets.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, the thing is that, I mean, as long as there are top prizes out, of course they'll keep selling them.
But there weren't. I'm saying, but nobody knew
right,
that.
But
you
they
had
were
no
all one. Gone, and so, I mean, you had no chance of getting it because they've all been won.
But even worse, if there were five left and only 20% of tickets left, they'd pull the game.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, screwball stuff like that. But
anyway, what did you think of the goings-on yesterday? Like I said, I'm very hopeful that it comes to some sort of a conclusion. I have a little bit of issue with the dude, as everybody knows, but it seems to be a little too much of the Donald Trump show and not the peace show, but I guess that's just his style. Plus, he started launching off into stuff about banning ballots by mail, like in the middle of the news conference, when he obviously had other stuff on the plate. Can the guy hold a thought? But let's say this works out. What are we, if there's a peace guarantee, meaning some sort of a treaty, does he have any intention of taking that to the Senate, or is he just going to do an executive order and I made a treaty and where's my peace prize?
Well, that's if it's an actual treaty, has to go to the Senate. Well,
so don't you think some sort of a promise to help or a security guarantee is the same as a NATO treaty? What's the difference?
No, it's not. And that's for one thing, one expires when he leaves office; the other one doesn't. I mean,
well, okay, that was my next question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that the treaties have to go through the Senate, okay, and be ratified.
Oh, so is anybody going to believe any sort of a security guarantee that's only good for another 3 years?
Well. Here's the basic, as I pointed out in the article I put up yesterday, which I wrote over the weekend. So of course, it was before I had knowledge of, how this was going to go, right, one way or another. One of the points that I made is that since this thing started, Putin has had one set of requirements, and they haven't changed. Okay. So, people say, he's moved the line. No, he hasn't moved the lines.
Oh, he hasn't. He has not. I agree with you.
He has not moved the lines at all. And in fact, the essence of his line it goes all the way back to Khrushchev, and in fact, for 300 years before that, all right, that, that Crimea in particular, it was depending on how you look at it, was either bought or it was the outcome of the Ottoman-Turkish conflict over there at the time.
Everybody steal a whole bunch of the Ottoman Empire or what? Pretty much.
Well, the Ottoman Empire over the space. I mean, the last vestiges of it got blown up by by the world wars.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the thing is that then again. How did they get it? Well, they took it by force. Okay,
so the thing kind of fell apart after World War One. Well, everybody grabbed their piece.
Well, I understand that, yeah. but the point is that the origination of it wasn't peaceful.
No, God no.
So I mean, it's not like violence has not been the answer. It, by the way, always has been. It's not a new thing. Of course, violence is the answer. Anytime you have negotiations that fail, where people continue to disagree and say, "Well, I insist on it being my way," then the next thing that happens is violence.
Mike Royko's definition of war: they got it, we want it, let's take it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's everybody's definition of war is we tried to come up with some kind of a thing that everybody could live with, and we failed.
You're talking about an era where people tried first. There was an era when they didn't even do that.
Well, a lot of times they didn't bother trying because they knew there wasn't going to be a.
Or they just didn't care. You think the Romans cared?
Let's just get to the part where we actually go get what we want, right? But the thing is that on the other side, is that since this thing started, Ukraine has refused to concede any of those points. All right. Now, has there actually been a breakthrough there or not? Because unless there is, then this does not end. All right. And frankly, You know, as I've pointed out, I think the basic premise, which is, by the way, we've had a naval port at, you know, Sevastopol, and the land upon which it sits for 300 years, we're not giving it up. That's the end of the conversation. And if you really think you can take it from us, and by the way, you more or less agreed that you'd leave us alone with it there, and then you changed your mind. If you think we're giving it up, then you're going to have to literally blow it out of our fingers. Okay, now, and what people also need to understand is that I suspect that behind all of this, because the idea of sanctions is you can strangle people economically and get them to do what you want without having to shoot them, that's a nice premise, except we have this other geopolitical issue over there with regards to China. China and Russia share a land border, and we know China and India also are buying all the oil Russia wishes to sell them. Trump has threatened but not yet actually imposed on India derivative sanctions for this. The Congress, interestingly enough, has, through the Senate and pending in the House, a bill that would lay 500% derivative tariffs on anybody that buys Russian oil. Now,
including people here? I'm sure people here are buying it.
But the thing is, and that, by the way, that bill has it passed with a strong bipartisan vote in the Senate, and it has strong bipartisan support in the House. So that is, you talk about, Trump just unilateral. Well, that's not unilateral. That's actually coming out of Congress. And while it is pending in the House, and the House is on recess right now, that will obviously, be on the menu at some point. Is there actually a willingness to effectively lay an economic embargo, which is what a 500% tariff would be, on both India and China? Because if you aren't,
the answer is no.
The answer is no. So if you're not willing to do that, then Putin is sitting there laughing at you. Okay. And so, because economically, as long as he can fund this thing, numerically, he's got a ridiculous numerical advantage, and he's happy to watch us burn up, $500 billion worth of our crap. So I think there's...
He can't, the thing of it is, though, he can't be, even though the dude doesn't seem to care one way or the other, an awful lot of people around him got really... I keep saying this, and I'm obviously wrong, but he's got an awful lot of people around him that really got into the good life while he was there. No longer in the good life to the extent that they were.
Well, absolutely.
And there's a lot of people dead, and I got to believe there's some blowback with that.
Well, there's a huge number of people dead on both sides. Okay, but the other thing that has come out of this, which is a substantial problem, is that when this all started, we destroyed our ability to export inflation through trade balance. It's gone. Now, that is why we had this big spike during the back half of Biden's presidency. Okay? By the way, we not only haven't cut the deficit spending down to size, we've increased it. So anybody that thinks that we've got a path forward to continue to do that without paying for it economically has rocks in their head. And, by the way, we also have no intention to stop doing it.
We have a succession of presidents that don't seem to know how to add.
Well, okay, Chief, we also have a succession of presidents who presided over a world in which we, through the sequestration of dollars, when you are the preferred trade currency because your currency and its regulatory regime is more stable than the alternatives. It has nothing to do with us, pointing 6,000 nuclear weapons at somebody and saying do it or else. It is entirely the fact that you are less likely to get screwed out of your money when goods and services
are
in transit.
You absolutely have gotten screwed out of your money in the last 5 years.
Well, except that now we've turned around and we've said we're going to screw you out of your money anytime we want to, even though you didn't necessarily have anything to do with whatever. Okay.
Well, would anybody when we've well, long before we first started the show, we used to talk about somebody on was a guest talking about how the single biggest wealth holding in Russia in some of these places that were, I use the term backward, even though they're not totally backward, where people would gather up U.S. $100 bills, and that was their savings. Now, those $100 bills are worth what now, $50 compared to 5 years ago?
Well, okay, but $50 is better than zero.
Okay, $2 would be better than zero, but still, it's not a storehouse of value, and we've done that to ourselves because some people do very well with that.
Absolutely, but the point stands that when goods and services are in transit in international trade, if you've been paid and you haven't gotten it yet, but you're in the process of delivering, you were at risk of a 100% loss. And if that happens to you, you're out of business. So to the extent that you can mitigate that risk, or that you believe you can, whether it's real or not, and therefore you demand your payment in dollars, the United States benefits from this because it's not the flow, it's the delta. So if you go from a true... Well, but that's the point.
Hey, we only got a couple minutes, but I think the other guys are on today, but we talked about it yesterday a little bit. The size of the wealth in the cryptocurrencies. I mean...
It's not wealth, and you know that as well as I do, Chief.
I'm saying...
You're a trader.
The size of the nominal
the
wealth.
The size of the encapsulated funds.
The size of the nominal... what people think they have. It's like the total value of all the tulips on the top. Yeah. It wasn't a problem until it got that big. What if there's some bleep up in the cryptocurrency world and the $2 trillion goes down to half a trillion or something?
It's going to happen.
I know, but I'm saying how big, my question is, and it's hard for anybody, but you know, you can make a better guess than most. If that were to happen suddenly...
Right.
It's 5 years ago when there was a couple hundred billion in there, I thought it was a problem if something bad happened, a problem that you get over in a week or a month or something. I right now I'm thinking it's a really big problem if everything would happen there.
It's the fuse that blows up the world.
I still don't think most people here are a part of that. Where is the concentration of this wealth? Is it just in drug dealers? I mean, where is it? I have no idea. I'm asking a question.
Well, it's all over the place, but I mean, there's a bunch of, particularly with Bitcoin.
Well, Trump's got a bunch of it.
Well, but particularly with Bitcoin, one of the biggest problems of trying to figure out exactly where it is, an awful lot of it, huge percentage, is in what are called cold wallets. They've never transacted. And so, and by the way, there's no disclosure as to who holds any of them. All right, so there's a real problem here that's very significant, and it's very hard to get a finger on that exactly where that stands. But the other thing about that is that I know you know this, Chief, but a lot of the listeners don't realize it. Although many of them live in it, although they don't realize it, they won't admit it to themselves. If I'm sitting there and I get my statement from FIDO or Schwab or Vanguard or whoever,
PTI for instance,
or PTI, and and it says, hey, there's $5 million in here, okay, I am far more likely to go out and spend every penny that I made last week, okay, all of it, without a care in the world. I will go out and I will do that because I'm rich.
Yeah, well.
But the problem is you're not, okay? And what, you know, as you
Well, you
know,
are if they're in T-bills.
Well, but they're not, okay? Yes, if they're in T-bills, you
we got a bunch. We got a bunch of people like that are probably 30% T-bills, and the rest, they have everything's got to put below it, so their total risk is probably 5%.
Well, okay.
Yeah, but not many people are like that. I get it.
But very few people are like that, okay? Most people have, you know, have between the Mag 7, they probably got 70% of their so-called wealth.
Without a doubt. The more it goes up, the more concentrated they get.
Well, exactly. And the thing, the problem with that is...
Hey, do you see Joel yet?
Not yet.
No.
Okay, well, as soon as he pops in, we'll...
But I don't see, you know, that is it. And then you get this stuff like I just got from a unnamed brokerage that's like, hey, man, if you retire now, but there's a gap between, you know, then and 65 when you are eligible for Medicare. By the way, here's $20,000 of expense every single year for shitty insurance. It's not going to do anything with health care. And, you know, this is, have you considered this? Well, I'll tell you what I think people ought to consider in that situation, given what all of these entities, including every brokerage, has suborned and supported, which is screw it, drop it, deal with the fact that if it happens, you're dead. And, oh, by the way, since I'm dead, guess what? Now I'm going to play the game of scoreboards. And as long as my score is greater than one, I win.
Well, you
want to know how it stops, Chief? Because as it turns out, this plays right back to this whole thing with Putin and Russia, right? At the end of the day, the only thing that stops bullies is either a credible threat of violence or actual violence.
I'm with you on that. I don't see how the guy stops here. I tell you what, if Trump can pull it off, my hat's coming off to the roof.
Hey, listen, if he actually gets a settlement, okay. All right, we'll see. I don't know, but frankly, I think this whole thing about, you know, Z bringing, you know, all these people from the EU with him into my opinion, that's stupid. All right, but that's what they did.
No man can do only one thing, right? If you bark like whatever or bleat like he does. For now, pushing 5 years about how those guys have to be a bigger part of the expense, and a lot of them have, you know.
Maybe. Oh, yeah.
Now, but once you do that, now they're part of the decision process as well, aren't they?
Well, okay. That's a fair point, I think.
I mean, when we decided that we were going to protect Europe and we were going to protect Japan, and spent a boatload of money doing that, people say, "Why do we do that? Oh God, they should." Reason why we did that is because we wanted to.
Yeah, and you know,
if we didn't want Japan ever messing with us again, and if we had 90 gazillion guys on Okinawa to make sure it didn't happen, and 15 nuclear weapons, that's what we did. The last thing we wanted in 1965 was the Germans to have a 300,000 person standing army, well equipped.
By the way, Joel's up.
Okay.
So I'll let him go.
I think Kenny's on, but if not, we'll talk at you soon. SP Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 40. Joel, how are you, buddy?
Good morning, Chief. How you doing on this Tuesday morning?
I'm doing all right. Although I have to say that the biorhythms are taking a hit, because the last couple days are the first days this year yet where when I come in and it's dark.
My wife just mentioned that to me. We were just talking about that last night, because some friends asked me to go out on a boat kind of later on, and she's like, well, what time is it getting dark? But no dark days in the market, Chief.
No. Well, your interest rates have crept back up again. But why is it the 30s crept back up more than the 10 this time? Last time the 30 almost went through 5, the 10 was at 4.45, and now it's a point below, and then a 30 year is moving more than the 10. Is there, what do you think of that? Is that just nothing, or was there a reason?
No one knows what the hell to do. Maybe that's, you know, that it was the opposite for a while. You know how markets change, you know, character and. Chief, this whole interest rate thing, this whole Fed, this whole inflation thing, ad nauseum, you get such conflicting inflation reports. I just think people just, you know, on the short end of the curve, on the long end of the curve, you know, and also you gotta, you know, take it into consideration the weakening dollar. I mean, just a lot of facts. And I'm not an economist, Chief, so can't get a great answer out of me on that one.
Well, I'm gonna say, for some reason, and I can't pinpoint it, I don't know if it's the administration, if it's some behind the scenes people who run the world or whatever, but the kickstart in the money supply that started in November of 23, that essentially is worldwide and now is accelerating dramatically on our end, is we're about there where it starts percolating through the inflation numbers. And it's going to hit right about the same time the tariff stuff comes through. And the tariff's not as bad as Trump said it was going to be. And, you know, it's not to 50% or whatever, but there's some there. These numbers are going to come crashing together somewhere in September, October, November. They can't not. And anybody who's shopping lately, and I'm not talking about, you know, the stuff that goes up and down all the time, the chicken and whatever. I mean, I bought a quart of oil, like, I have to use it, you know, and on Sunday, and it was 3 years ago, it was 6.25, then it was 6.95, it was $8.40. You know, we're talking stuff that you're not even thinking about, you know, that is creeping up. And by the way, the price of oil is down. So it's the inflation is there. The money's in the system. And Hal did a study where we're going to be at 10% money supply growth by the end of the year. Well, our regular growth, what do you think our growth is? 1.5, maybe? So that's 9% inflation, no matter how you cut it, even though you're not supposed to look at those numbers in the modern monetary theory. Simple fact is, that's been monetary theory back to the Stone Ages, for God's sake. You put money in the system, stuff goes up, right? Too much money chasing too few goods. Duh. And now you got
if you go into eyeball test, Chief,
an eyeball.
Everywhere you go.
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere you go. I mean, except for gasoline, you know, except at the pump, except for oil. And oil is a big component of it. But, I mean, you know, fast food restaurants, you know, look what some of the restaurant stocks have done. Grocery store. Oh, I probably should pay more attention to the prices of stuff at the grocery store.
Look at insurance.
Oh.
Do you have a, without getting personal, do you have a personal umbrella policy?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Have you gotten your bill this year? Mine's double last year.
Yeah, which you keep trying to keep that down and keep the same coverage. But, yeah, where does that show up, Chief? And then you get the divergence between the CPI and the PPI, and, you know, you're scratching your head. But I guess it just doesn't matter until it matters, Chief, kind of like the valuations in stocks.
Well, yeah, if stocks are, this is, you and I have seen this, Joel, and I don't want to see it again, to be honest with you. We've seen it a couple times. If you and I look at IBM and it's trading 239, and we do our, and you're more of a technical guy, and you know, I'm somewhat of a half-assed fundamental guy, and I say, gee, you know, IBM is, you know, their normal, I don't know what their PE is, but I'm just, I'll lob one out there, but say their normal PE is 12, and God, it looks like it's 13.5, you know. IBM's a little, you know, maybe a little more pricey historical than normal. That, you know, that's not a cause for a trade or anything like that. Yet I look at some of these things, and I'm looking at the, you know, some of the revenue per share is, you know, 25, 30. And yet the crash of 2000, the big stocks got to, what, 11 or 12, and they collapsed. You know, where we're, if somebody wakes up and goes to value on some of these things, we're not talking about IBM going from 239 to 222 or to be a great buy. And some of this stuff to me is 2 or 3 times what normal is. Yet you can't, in my opinion, you can't look at an individual stock and say XYZ has these ridiculous valuations. It could be the stock 5 years from now that's you know, one of the best stocks in the world. But you look at 10 of them and you go, they all can't do that, can they? I mean, or else we're gonna have to colonize Mars because we're not that big. I mean, I feel the same way now as I did in 2000. Yet, you know, I put money to work for people all the time. We just, depending on their station in life, we either have some protection for them or not if they're young enough. But, I mean, it's, you look at the stuff and you go, how much higher really can it go? I mean, NVIDIA is a spectacular company. But right now, they have to, like, triple to grow into any kind of normal. And they
people
may.
People have been saying that. But people have been saying that's a long time. And
I'm with you.
They have. I mean, they've proved the doubters wrong. So, You know, looking at the forward PE, I mean, you know, until those numbers start to come down, it's very hard to fight the momentum.
Well, you always had no problem when the Lone Ranger always came over the hill, you know, the Fed or somebody. And one day, the problem is you don't need a guy where the Lone Ranger's out to lunch. Because there's nothing that says we all could trade last year pretty well, even you and I, right?
Yep.
Its problem is it's next year.
Yep, and it, we got things coming on down the line. But
what are you thinking? Are you? I suspect you're staying away from the top seven a little bit. Although I don't know you.
Yeah, I mean, I got some concentration. I mean, I have, I've been very conservative, over the years, and, not get like the astronomical. I mean, some stocks you do, but pretty try to be a steady Eddie, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8% per year, maybe 10 on a good year, and then on these bad years, try not to be down more than 10%. So slow and steady wins the race. Very nervous about the market, very nervous about the global macro situation, but just the market refuses to buckle.
Oh, yeah.
So that's it. Before I go, I only got a minute or two left here. I just wanted to talk. Now I know you guys have your fine show until 8 a.m. Right? You're on
yep.
for another 15 minutes. But if and I don't know how
no,
much.
No, we're on for another hour and 15 minutes.
Okay, hour and 15 minutes. But I just wanted to, Chief has been a guest of mine on.
And I love it, by the way. It's beautiful.
Yep. The Stock Trader Network, and I just wanted to say, if you're a more, and I don't even have to say it, we're not all day traders, but more active investors, you're trying to keep an eye on your portfolio, swing trading, following the news flow, we're fantastic at following the news flow. Besides premarketprep.com, I've started a new company with a longtime friend and trader, Dennis Dick. And it's the StockTraderNetwork.com.
Wow.
And after 8 to 9 a.m. is when we do pre-market prep.
Is that Eastern or Central?
That's Eastern.
Okay.
So we conflict with your audience. I don't encourage everybody to stay and listen to the Chief and his crew. But if you want to, a little bit more granular look at the markets, opening and closing imbalances, how the order flow has changed from the pre-market to the after hours, how analyst ratings are affecting the markets. Try out the Stock Trader Network.
I would do that for sure. I mean, why not?
Yeah, and I just want to give a code, PMPSTN. So if you go to StockTraderNetwork.com and you put in the code PMPSTN, that gives you 10% off. And Chief, of all the years we've been doing the interviews, I thought there was one question you were going to ask me today, and you didn't.
What was that?
I don't think we have time for it.
What do I think of Michigan?
Yeah.
I think we'll do that next week, because let's figure out how bad the scandal was. I don't think anybody cares, do they?
Exactly. I'm still formulating my thoughts, and I don't want to go on national radio until I've totally formulated my thoughts, but I just want to say,
you know what, yes. if you want, I mean, I'm not, if you got a few minutes, I could, because Kevin's been digging this pretty heavy, why don't you pile on when he's on, either Wednesday or Friday morning for 10 minutes, and we'll go through it, because he knows more about it than I do, for sure.
What time is that? What time is Kevin on?
He's on from, 6 to 7 our time on Wednesday and Friday, and he'd love to have, talk about it with you, who knows more about it than me. So
is that Central?
Yeah.
6 and 7?
Yeah.
What's his last name?
Kevin O'Neill. He used to write for Irish Eyes. And he's
okay. Because we've been going back and forth email a little bit. But let me check my schedule.
Yeah, that's a big story.
Yeah. Worst comes to worst, we can talk about it next Tuesday. My most overriding concern was that I would have to get rid of 7 shirts, 4 t-shirts to say national champ on it, 2 collared shirts, and a pullover.
Yeah.
So this, I get to keep my 7 pieces of it. Well, I could keep them and I would still wear them, but
Well, isn't there some way you could stitch over it?
No need, Chief.
No need.
Okay.
All right, bud.
Got a hop. Right. I'll let you know if I can come on with Kevin, and if not, we'll talk.
If not, well, maybe he can pile on for 5 minutes next Tuesday.
Okay.
All right, bud.
Go Blue.
Do we have Kenny?
Yes, we do.
We do.
Kenny, how are you, bud?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. So are you dining? Are you having a beer at the Cowboy Bar in Jackson Hole tonight?
No, I am not in Jackson Hole. Thank you very much. I'm back in my office in Jupiter.
I'm so disappointed you're not invited.
So am I.
What's the deal? What is that group? Because when Paul talks, that's not on TV, right?
No, it's not on TV. They may get little blips of it, but it won't be on TV. You know, they'll show it after the fact, I think, if they show anything. But no, it's on a broadcast speech. It will come on Friday at 10 o'clock. It will be certainly the highlight of the event, right, is the keynote. But look, and I said it in my note this morning, I don't think Powell's going to use it, and nor should he use it, as an FOMC preview meeting, right? That's not what this is about. The theme is different, so he'll talk about the broader theme that the event is hosting. But I do think that, you know, we can't help but address the pending situation about what I think he's going to remain very flexible. He's going to remain emphasize data dependency. I think he's going to commit to anything. I certainly don't think he's committing to a 50 basis point rate cut, nor do I think he's going to commit to, you know, X amount of rate cuts by the end of the year. I think he's going to continue his posture that he remains data dependent and that we're getting closer to a rate cut. You know, I'd be very surprised if he promises a 25 basis point. I think that's what we're going to get, but I don't think he's going to promise that in any by any stretch. But I think people are going to hang on his every word trying to figure out, you know, did he really say it? Did he say it, you know, in some comment that he make? Is that his wink-wink way of saying, you know, get ready for a 25 basis point cut? I don't know. But I think that's going to be how it plays off, right?
He's already putting money in his system.
Yes, I understand that. Yeah, we talk about that all the time.
Why does nobody know about that except you and me, it appears, and a few other guys on the show?
I think they know about it. They just don't want to talk about it. You know, for whatever reason, I just don't think they want to talk about it. But one way that he is, and he's managing the system, and he's trying to be low key about it. But yeah, that's why I don't think you're going to get any commitment from him. I think he's going to continue to play it
I would say that all my years of doing the show and being in the business, I've never heard something talked about, and since CNBC's been on, and Fox, I'm sure too, as Jackson Hole, and I've never once heard anything come out of it that was worth anything. What your Jenny yelled at him ago, right?
Right. Nothing comes out of Jackson Hole that's going to be mind-boggling or game-changing, right? That's not what that's about. Some people would like to think that's what it's about. I don't think it is. Although I will say, in August of 2009, when the world was crashing, Ben Bernanke did, I believe, at Jackson Hole, make that announcement that the Fed was going to initiate this quantitative easing, which turned into 1, 2, 3, and then infinity.
Yeah.
Because the world was crashing at that point. So I do think that Bernanke actually used it as a moment in time. I don't believe Jake Powell is going to use it as a moment in time. We're not nearly in the same place. And I don't think he's going to use it as a platform to talk about U.S. monetary policy at the next Fed meeting.
Kenny, now, I don't want to be going out to, like, your driving range and do this like you're never supposed to do and yell like shank. You know, you're never supposed to do that, right? What if, and what if we are settling into some sort of a stagflation? You can't beat that by lowering rates.
You really can't beat it by raising rates either. No, and that's the fear, clearly that's what they're trying to prevent. But that's the fear, you know. Could we be spiraling into stagflation? I don't see it yet. Do I think there's a risk? I do think there's a risk, and the truth is, I think Jay Powell thinks there's a risk as well.
Well, I mean, what is your definition
of stagflation?
Yeah,
slower growth and higher prices.
I would say that high unemployment. Do you think our growth rate is over or under the inflation rate? I think it's under.
I think our growth rate is under, but our labor market, you know, our unemployment is only 4.2%. That's really considered full employment. So our labor market is not imploding, or at least not yet. You know, if we see suddenly a spike in the labor market over the next couple of months and unemployment spikes higher, then I'd be more concerned. But look, unemployment has remained at between 4 and 4.2% for the last, I don't know, year. Hasn't really gone anywhere, and that's considered full employment. So I'm not completely worried about the labor market falling off the edge. Now, look, we saw that adjustment that we got from the BLS. I get that. So that's starting to kind of just cause me to sit back for a minute and question. Let's see what the next NFP report says. Let's see what, you know, the data starts to tell us. But right now, with unemployment at 4.2%, it's not squeezing.
Why, without... Just for thoughts, for for Kenny Polcari thoughts out on his yacht. This is the truth, whether or not the guy was right or not. My first class in Notre Dame economics, the guy said, by the way, this unemployment report is a piece of crap. Don't ever pay any attention to it. That was how many years ago, Kenny? I mean, if you, instead of looking at that number, just try this. Look at the combined number of the people that are officially unemployed and looking for work versus the entire amount of people that are eligible for the labor force and not working. That number continues to go up, even though the number is like 110 million. The unemployed are looking for work is like 7.
Yeah.
So you can basically bleep back and forth between those two columns as much as you want, how you count if people are actually looking or not. The fact, and the number that I think, if you look more closely, maybe, not that you don't, look at the amount of people that are eligible in the population that are working, that ratio is continuing to go down. That is way more important than trying to figure out how many of the 110 million people that aren't employed. Now, a lot are students, a lot are retired. The whole number there is bigger. Because trying to figure out how many of the 110 are actually looking for a job, God, talk about a number that can be manipulated, for God's sake. I'm saying that the full number is how many people working are supporting people that aren't. Now, obviously, you're not supporting the people that are retired because they probably have money, and you're probably not supporting the students. Hopefully, they or parents have money. But the point is, we're down to like 58%. When we're healthy, that number is like 63 or 64. It's like millions of people. So the actual unemployment rate to me is a piece of crap. We're talking 7 million out of 110. That number could be 8 or could be 6, right? What's the difference? The fact is, they're not working.
Yeah, right. Right, they're not working.
So, I mean, when people dig out just that number, it means nothing. I mean, obviously, it's different if it's 4 versus 10. I get that part. But it's the last column that I keep looking at every month, and that's the one that's terrifying me. The combined number of people working versus all the people that aren't looking for jobs or other, that continues. Before, in 2000, that number was like 64, Kenny. Now it's like 58.5.
Yeah.
If that number got back to 61, whether or not they're looking for a job or not, I think a lot of our tax versus spend problems go away. The fact is, we don't. Plus the fact that, well, this is the household survey, so they're not counting two jobs. I think what you're seeing in some of these revisions, and the revisions aren't somebody in Washington doing it. We're talking about a couple hundred thousand people out of 160 million. And what percentage of it? And plus you've got the establishment survey, which they're talking about, counts if you have three jobs, you're counted three times. So it doesn't surprise me at all that if we're slowing down even a little, that people are losing their second or maybe their third job, and the revisions are bigger than normal. Why wouldn't they be? I mean, it doesn't appear to me that there's any kind of, the numbers there's a sloppy pickup. There always has been, right? And how do you try and figure out how many 160 million people, if that number is 161 or 159? I mean, especially if you count multiple jobs. I mean, the idea that somebody is cooking them or the revisions are too high, that somehow, and I've talked to people, outside the show, man, they're not doing their job. They should be exact. What do you mean? How can they be exact? What are you talking about? You're calling people up? I mean, It's a horse and buggy era. Okay. If they don't want to go do that, they could just take the ADP number, which is 45% of the people. They should take that number, okay, add government to it, which they ought to know because they're writing those checks. They could do it differently if they want to, but they're still doing the survey of firms. I mean, when my brother worked for GATX, they were then the magic number was, I forget what he told me, 2,000, 4,000 people working for you. They would send you the thing every month, and you'd tell them how many people were there. The next month, they would give you the opportunity to revise the month before whether you were wrong or not. It's not like somebody's sitting there making up people, I don't think. Do you?
No, I don't think they're making up people. No, not at all.
So, I mean, no. You know, the fact is there's more people that are eligible for work that are not working for whatever reason, looking or not, than 3 or 4 or 5 years ago by a huge number. And that's a problem.
Yeah, right. I agree it's a problem.
But to say that the official unemployment rate, because we've identified 7 million people who are actually looking versus 110, and we don't know what they're doing, I don't know where you get that number.
Yeah, I don't know where they get that number either.
I think they get it from people who are actually getting it. I think, Kenny, they're cheating, and Carl mentioned this before. What they're doing is if you get laid off and you get, what do you get unemployment for? Is it 6 months? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's, is it 6 months?
Let's say it's 6 months.
Yeah.
The day you don't get your check,
right?
You roll off, allegedly, for when you're getting the check, you're supposed to be looking for a job. Now, whether you are or not, who knows?
Yeah.
And afterwards, I think what they do, they lose track of you, so you're, in their mind, you're no longer looking. I think if you're not getting the check, you fall off.
You're no longer looking, right.
Which makes no sense. I mean, you could be looking harder 7 months in, right? Listen,
I agree with you. So that's right. But how do they account for that, right? If you're not receiving, how do they account whether you're looking or not? There's no one to confirm whether you're looking or not, right?
When there's nobody to confirm it before either, other than you're supposed to be.
Well, they're supposed to be. When you're collecting, you're supposed to go there and prove that you're actually looking for a job while you're collecting, right? I've never collected, so I'm assuming that's how it works.
Actually, I collected once when everybody at Pullman got laid off. There were so many people at Pullman got laid off, they said, don't even bother coming in, we're enough people. I got a job right away, and I actually was honest enough to call them and say, by the way, I got a job.
Right, you got a job.
Well, I mean, I could have snuck a few weeks, I'm sure. But I didn't.
Right.
I mean, obviously, if I was a carpenter, I could have snuck forever, probably, and got paid cash. But I didn't. You know, and I think a lot of people don't. But my point is, it's the total number that's very nervous right now to me. And just go to the A1 thing and take a look, see if I'm really right or not. Because that number, it's called the labor participation rate, and I think it's down to 58 something.
Yeah.
And you know, when we were healthier and 2000, it was 63.5, 64. Hell, what's 6% times 160 million people? That's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. Correct.
So I mean, the numbers these guys are touting, it seems like they're all just, I don't know, they got their own agenda and they're using the number to force it in there or something. You know, you and I don't. I mean, we're trying to find the truth here, obviously.
Yeah, no, I hear you. They're trying to find the truth. I agree with you. But I don't know how I don't know how you can account for that, right? They do the best they can, but I don't, you know, I'm not, you're really not going to get an actual verifiable account, right?
Well, yeah, you're not. That's why I think they just cut back. If you're not getting a check, you're not looking.
Right. Yeah, right. I think, and I'm not necessarily sure I agree with that, but it is the way, that's the way it works at the moment. That's the way it's always worked. So the data's consistent in the sense that that's the way it's always worked, right?
Yeah.
I'm
not so sure about that. I think they might have lazed. It's not like recently. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
But I mean, my point is, if it's 5 years from now, and the unemployment, the amount of people unemployed officially still remains at 7.2 or whatever it is right now. It's right around 7 million. If the number that aren't working but they're not looking goes from 103 million to 140, I think we got a problem, right? Even though the official number is 7.
Yeah, no. We have a problem, yes.
Even though some are in school and some are retired and, you know, and they're not bothering anybody. I mean, that's what people do. That's saying these numbers are all so weird that if you zero in on one of them to prove your point, no matter what it is, somebody can kind of say to you, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about, right?
And they will, right? If they don't understand it, they will ask you what you're talking about. And it's always, and it's, so then you always have to be able to prove it. Yeah. I guess that's going to be, that's always the difficult part, right? How do you prove it? This thing with the BLS, how do you prove that, right? Is it right or wrong? Did they legitimately undercount? Did they legitimately hold back in order to create all this, you know, this negative press? Or was it in fact real that they didn't have the data on time, that people don't submit the data on time, that there have to be adjustments along the way? I don't know. I'm kind of mixed on whether or not I think it was partisan or not. I do not think it was partisan. I think it's just the way they collect the data.
Okay, I think that one of the, if I tell you what, you and I can, and I think we're in total agreement on that. We're never supposed to be in total agreement on the radio, but we are. My thoughts on this are always the birth and death issue. And I think that their job has gotten harder as more and more people become 1099 workers, because they really don't know that they're a worker till January, right?
Right.
And somebody somewhere, some group in charge of this birth and death number.
Right.
And I've always been, since you and I have known each other, I've said I've always thought, and I've watched these numbers, God, like you, like since we're in college, for God's sake, when the economy's growing. In my opinion, it's always growing faster than they say.
Right.
Because you and I are going to say, boy, everything looks pretty damn good. Let's build five houses. And we're going to hire 15 guys, and we're going to build five houses, and we're not going to pay them cash and not pay Social Security. We're going to pay them by check, and we're going to give them a 1099 probably next January, and it's the first time the government hears about them that they're working. Unless, in the household survey, somebody calls their home and says, is Joe working? The answer is yes. But they're not getting picked up in the establishment survey, correct? Because there's no establishment, because we're too small to call. But now all of a sudden there's 15 people that weren't working that are. And again, the numbers are picked up differently, household versus establishment. So at the end of the year, they're going to get these 1099s. They say, wow, these guys are working. So there's going to be some adjustment. Somebody has to estimate this.
Correct.
And now the next year, if the economy goes to bleep, we say, we're not building houses this year. These 15 guys are gone. Well, nobody knows that until next January.
That's right. So I think it expands faster than we recognize, and I think it declines faster than we recognize.
And I think there was a huge adjustment on this. And the only time I thought there was a real snafu in this, Kenny, was somewhere after Obama took office, and there was a big problem in 2007, and somehow at the end of that year, in an effort to say that, you know, we weren't in a recession, which we were, I think, somebody came out and put the birth and death numbers that in the year after the 2008 crash, somehow or another, more businesses were formed than weren't. And I go, wait a minute. No freaking way that happened. So I think you can get some editorializing, shall we say, in those numbers. I don't think you're gonna get them in the somebody saying, hey, I told you we hired 50 people last month. Turns out we didn't. You know, that type of thing. I don't see that happening, but it could. You know, who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. So what are we saying? I think, you know, I mean, you and I have talked. We can go over a couple of minutes if you get. You and I have talked about the CPI.
Yeah.
It's messed up. But by the way, you and I wouldn't want the job, would we?
No, I don't want. No. I don't want that job at all. CPI, PPI, I want none of it at all.
Yeah, I mean,
because all you're going to do is get shit for it, right?
Yeah.
No matter what you do, someone's not going to be happy, and someone's going to start screaming and yelling. So I get no interest at all. I do, though, think that the CPI, I think the PPI really tells the story. The fact that the PPI last week was much hotter than expected, right? It was 0.7% hotter than expected. I think that suggests what Powell's been afraid of, that prices are going up, but producers have been eating them until the whole tariff thing settles in. They haven't been passing them along yet. They're trying to wait and see how this settles in. And I think that's always been Powell's stance, that that's what he's worried about. And in fact, if that's true, that we saw that start to happen last month with the PPI. Suddenly it spiked up, suggesting that the producers are just eating it. They're not passing it along, because CPI was only up 0.1%. You know, the day before. But I think you may see that change next month, because if they start passing along, it takes like 4 to 6 weeks between when it goes from producer to consumer.
I'm looking at the October, maybe November numbers as being, watch it.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, though, on a political side. And this is not, you know, not Dems and Republicans. And the CPI, I don't know if you know, maybe you're not mentioned when you were on, one of the guys who helps out on the show, Mike Murphy, his friend of mine since high school, his mom was a collector for the CPI, yeah. for BLS in the Cleveland yeah. area. And he told me once, I forgot, she had a whole bunch of things she checked out. Was it rice and macaroni? I mean, it was a bunch of stuff. Oh, yeah. She went from place to place. And yeah. I don't think that Mike's mom torpedoed the numbers. I don't see that happening. I mean, but yet if you look at the CPI, there's two things that absolutely come flying off the page if you look at it every month. One is the medical piece and one's the housing piece. That somebody somewhere, I don't know if it's the Oval Office on down, somebody for a period of 25 years has said, we're cheating on these numbers. Because they're so far off that if you adjusted them, the CPI would probably have doubled over the last 20 years. Now, that's not the call of some, I won't say rummy, or some regular worker going out and finding out the price of chicken at the store. Somebody somewhere is making that call. It's, you know, we're going to maintain that medical stuff is 6.5% of the economy, even though we know it's 21%. That's,
right.
I mean, that's an above my pay grade if I'm just a regular schlump call. Where do you think that call gets made? And I just did a study last week, Kenny, on the housing piece, the housing equivalent rent.
Yeah.
It's up 110% since 2000. Well, houses have damn near tripled. Taxes have got to be up at least triple, and the price of homeowners insurance is up five times. So how the hell? I mean, are they at barely doubling?
Well, it's doubling because I think the Fed's completely responsible for that, right?
No, I'm saying it's probably double their double is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it could be. That's why, in my opinion, rates should stay right where they are, because you need to see a real retracement in housing prices. And if they cut rates, all they're going to do is stimulate that economy, that housing market again, and that's not what you want to do at all. And look, if they cut rates by 25 basis points, mortgage rates aren't coming down 4%. They're not coming down hardly at all on a 25 basis point cut. So who are they kidding? I think they need to stay right with, okay, so if we cut by 25 basis points, okay, so mortgages go from 6.75% to maybe 6.6%. Okay, that's fine. And I still think it's going to create, because you can start to see it happening. I'm seeing it down here in Florida. You're starting to see housing prices, not on the water, but away inland, you're starting to see housing prices become much more negotiable, right? You're starting to see cuts in offerings in terms of prices, right? Price cuts versus price raises.
There's a guy on a, and we'll dash and get the hell, but there's a guy, I just was wandering through YouTube, and this guy was talking about the crash had already started. I thought he was talking about the market. I'm saying, what's he looking at? I mean, to me, it's going up still. And he was talking about Florida, Georgia, and Texas. Housing prices are already flying down. Is that true?
Well, in Florida, I can start to see it. Like in Port St. Lucie, in Stuart, if you're off the water,
okay.
I'm starting to see much more give in housing prices. I'm starting to see price declines. If you look on Zillow or Realtor.com, you're starting to see, you know, prices coming down. Because they tell you, they'll tell you on Zillow, you know, price cut $10,000 or price cut $15,000. It tells you right on Zillow every time they cut the price. So I am starting to see that. Interestingly enough, though, I don't see it when I go to New York City. New York City condo prices are still elevated. There's not much movement, but the prices are still elevated.
Yeah,
people in New York City are not coming to the realization that they need to cut their price.
Well, this guy identified Florida, Georgia, and Texas, and he had a bunch of examples in Texas of actually houses that BlackRock bought.
They
bought it like $450, and they're now trying to get rid of them at $4.
Yeah, well, because BlackRock, you know, during that crisis, they went and bought them all up and decided they were going to be the homeowner.
What's wrong?
Last resort.
I would have thought
they want to be it.
I would have thought the economies in Georgia and Texas are two of the best, and I would never have started there to look.
Yeah, no, and I agree, and I think the economy here in Florida is pretty good, and I think if this guy gets elected in New York, I think the Florida economy is going to get another boost, because I think a lot of people are going to say screw it, and they're moving out of New York if this guy wins. And they're going to come down to places like, you know, Georgia and Texas and Florida.
Do you think, I mean, I'm not a New York dude like you are, but mean, I can see that we got a guy in Chicago that we can't wait to get rid of. Does the guy in New York have any talent whatsoever? If he wins, he's not just people don't like, but does he have any talent? Can he learn? I guess my question.
This guy running for mayor.
Yeah,
he's 31 years old. He's never held a real job.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, he's 31 years old and never held a real job. He's done a great job of running a TikTok campaign and an Instagram campaign, and he's ignited this base, this 25 to 35 year old base that feels neglected and left out. They can't find, they can't buy a house, they can't do this, they can't live in New York, it's too expensive. And so this guy tapped right into that. And I will say, I congratulate him for running a campaign that was able to ignite that age group. But the kid's 31 years old. He's never had a full-time job. Yet he wants to now be in charge and control of the nation's largest city. There's 11 million people in Manhattan.
We got a guy here who's a community organizer. Is that even a job?
Exactly. Don't even get me started on who else is a community organizer. But that's the deal. And what's funny is he grew up in a very wealthy family. Both his mother and father, there's plenty of money there. The kid grew up very wealthy, went to private schools, all that stuff. Yet, he stands up and says he's against capitalism, that he doesn't think billionaires should exist, and he doesn't think capitalism should exist, and it's all about, spreading the wealth, taking from you and giving to other people. He's anti-capitalism, besides being anti-Semitic and socialist. You know what I mean? That's a whole nother conversation. But it's amazing to me because I do think he's going to win. I do think he's going to win because the field is now fractured. You got Adams, you got Cuomo, and you got Sliwa. And now I understand there's a fourth guy.
I heard about that too.
A young Spanish guy who's from Cuba, who's anti everything that this guy stands for, right? Anti-socialism, anti all this stuff. But he threw his name in that. So now now it's even fractured further. And so I think they're going to hand this guy a win.
Well, next week, if we get a chance, Kenny, let's talk a little bit about where that comes from. I mean, where that attitude sort of comes from. And it's not – you and I can sit there as a couple of old farts, but you know what? They're not all wrong on that attitude. They're not – they shouldn't be mayor, but they're not all wrong.
No, and I get it, but I got to tell you, and who do we have to blame? We only have ourselves to blame because they kept rates way too low for too long. They inflated asset prices, and they left, all the people, the working class, they kind of left them out. So guess what? They brought this on themselves.
Yep.
So,
I wish we could go back in time to about August of 1929 just to get a feel. I wonder if we're not close. I hope not. A few people controlling everything. Hope we're not there because I don't want to.
I hope not.
Hope not. Anyway, and then on that happy note, I hope you guys are. You can't be any more humid than we are. This has been the most humid summer.
No, it's actually not so humid. I got to be honest with you. The weather was. I mean, other than being hot, and yesterday was only in the 90s. It wasn't like it was 115. It was in the 90s. It was beautiful. It wasn't humid at all.
Well, good for you, and stay out of the way of these hurricanes. This one's going
to go. I'll see you.
Yeah, all right. Take care. We have Hal. I assume we have Hal. Hey, how are you, buddy? Sorry for running over with Kenny, but it's...
Oh, it's all good.
I love listening
to you guys banter, so it's all good.
On the last couple of subjects we covered, why don't you pick one and opine on it? What do you make of...
The inflation thing is the big thing. You look at the yields. All the Treasury yields but two are below the Fed funds rate. Target, and so where is this money coming from? I think the money's coming from margin debt. So these banks making these loans, and that's juicing the stock markets. So
well, you got people making loans on Bitcoin.
It's the Cantillon effect. I built this model called that looks at Cantillon's model of money, and I'm telling you, man, we got to revisit these old guys, these old French guys.
Oh yeah.
Well, Cantillon's actually Irish, I believe. He grew up. Richard Cantillon was Irish, and I don't think he had a formal education, but he moved to France and worked for his uncle, I think, as a merchant, and then he got a job as a banker, and then England went to war against Spain, I believe, and he became a purchaser. So he was the guy that was buying ammunition and uniforms for the British troops.
It's always been a good business.
Yeah, and he created these really incredible networks. And all of his knowledge is... he didn't go to college, I don't think. But everything he learned was on the job. And he just observed. And then he started speculating. You know, he would engage in these arbitrage trades where he would buy, like, wheat in one country and sell it in another country. And he engaged in these arbitrage trades. And then he got kind of mixed up in the Mississippi bubble, which is basically the bubble of the 1700s in France, where John Law was the first central banker of Europe. And, of course, that central bank caused inflation. And that's where the word millionaire comes from. And Cantillon, I mean, what I love about Cantillon is he has this real-world experience, and then he thinks about it in a way where his economics are informed by what's going on in the real world. And it's called the Cantillon effect. And it's what is driving the inflation today. This money that's being lent into existence touches the hands of a few people first. And they're the people that buy assets before prices have a chance to go up. And that's why you're seeing this run-up in the stock market, in housing, because you have a few people that touch this newly printed money. And, you know, the Fed doesn't make most money. Banks make most money through lending.
Well, in times like this, what you're talking about, the Fed has to retard that, and they're not retarding it enough, yeah. Correct?
They're not, no. Yeah. I don't think it really has anything to do with interest rates. I think the Fed is post-Keynesian. They set interest rates, and then banks will do what? They'll make loans. They'll satisfy the demand for loans. And if they have to print money, they'll print the money. And then at the end of the day, they don't have to meet the reserve requirement anymore. There's no reserve requirements.
Which is crazy.
So they'll accommodate whatever demand's out there. And if the demand is in loans for the purchasing of assets, they fill that gap.
Well, between our current president, who somehow grades himself, although not doing the same thing this time, yeah. And right now the Fed's number one goal, and I don't know, I think Powell's doing his best to maybe push against that a little bit. The number one goal is to maintain the bubble, because that's where everybody's money is.
Yeah.
He's created a bubble.
The banks have blown this bubble. There's a couple of bubbles out there. I mean, crypto's a bubble. What are people buying crypto? Because they know the Fed and the banking system in the United States is creating all this money.
It's an artificial stuff.
It has nothing to do with interest rates.
What do you suspect? I mean, I've been looking around. I can't find the numbers on this. What do you suspect the amount of margin has been lent now on cryptocurrencies?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can buy crypto with credit cards. You can't.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not talking about that kind of. I'm talking about margin.
Yeah, that's an even kind of a worse margin, well, right? Because that's 100% leverage as opposed to 50% leverage.
That we know of. All right. What I'm saying is, if I want to know how much money is borrowed on stocks, I can go to the FINRA, and they'll tell me.
Yeah.
They'll say what is the total margin debt, and we're off record a little bit, but we're really high. It's like. I'll find that on break, because it's easy.
I tweeted FINRA data, and it's topped $1 trillion margin debt.
Really? So we're at a record. But I mean, I don't think that counts. My question is, and I'm asking you
it would be interesting to know how much leverage is in Bitcoin.
That's what I'm saying.
I would suspect it's a lot.
But you know, it was a few years ago. It was none. You know, you couldn't borrow against it, but now I think you can. Let me see if AI, some people, once it's in your, if you get it in your brokerage account.
I think it's pretty hard to know how much of the Bitcoin run-up is leveraged. I think it's really hard.
Well, you could go to the places that do that are like Coinbase and places like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I
would suspect it's pretty high because, you know, average Americans who kind of bought into this Bitcoin thing, they want a piece of it, they're playing the lottery, you know, they got some credit card balance available. I could see them buying some Bitcoin because they see it going up, and They see where it was like 10 years ago. And Bitcoin is just a hedge against inflation. So the reason why one of the reasons why Bitcoin is so high is because the central banks throughout the world have just been working together and printing money. I mean, they've and it's really benefited the people at top. That's called the Cantillon effect. I think we have to rethink Adam Smith being the
according to AI, which I don't buy at all. They're talking 53 billion cryptocurrency collateralized loans.
Well, I think that might be like official channels, but
what is what is CeFi, centralized finance, and DeFi, decentralized finance? What the hell is that?
Yeah, no, man. I think a lot of times people make things sound really. It's like a doctor calling, you know, muscle the latissimus dorsi, which just means side muscle, right? I mean, people create this language to make things sound very complicated. And my job as an economist, as a teacher of economics, and as an explainer of it, is not to use that kind of convoluted 42% language to make myself look smart.
It went up DeFi, which is went up 42% in the last quarter. That's a lot.
Yeah. I think there's a bunch of unofficial. I think getting at how much of that Bitcoin is leveraged, that might not. You might not be able to get a number on that. I think any number out there is going to be off by a huge factor. Well, we're talking about official channels, right?
Careful, you're going to get stuck right here. I'm going to ask you this question.
Yeah.
The use of liquid staking tokens, LSTs, and liquid restaking tokens, LRTs, as collateral for margin loans is enabling circular strategies to amplify staking yields on assets like Ethereum. What in the hell are they talking about?
Well, Tom, I went to sleep last night around 2 in the morning, and I got up at 6, so right now, it's that sentence you just read to me is going in my brain, and it's just churning my brain. And
let me help you. The next one is in essence, which is what we're talking about. In essence, margin borrowing in the cryptocurrency market is a significant segment, with billions of dollars borrowed across both centralized and decentralized platforms. While decentralized lending has experienced substantial growth and innovation, it's essential to recognize that borrowing on margin carries inherent risk, amplified by the volatility of the crypto market. There you go.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I just think it's a huge number, and I don't think we're gonna ever really know the truth, because a lot of these transactions, you know, one reason why people like Bitcoin is because, you know, whatever, you know, you buy Bitcoin, you can put it in a wallet, nobody can touch it. Well, I think Kenny mentioned the fact that I think it was Kenny that mentioned that. Or maybe it was Carl.
Carl.
There are a bunch of cold wallets out there where Bitcoin is like probably lost forever, I would think.
You know what? I know you guys that know way more about this than me say that, but I'm going to say in my Southside upbringing, no friggin' way are those things going to stay there for the next 50 years and somebody's not going to be able to find a way to steal them.
Well, you know, if you put Bitcoin on a smartphone and you switch out your phone, I think you can lose your Bitcoin if that phone ends up in the landfill.
Yeah, I'm saying the idea that you know that there's no one everybody that knows more about it than me is always even the simple stuff like Kenny was maybe a month ago we're kind of arguing about Bitcoin or those things, and he goes, well, they're going to be regulated. Guess what? There's all kinds of stuff they're passing through about regulating them. I said, Kenny, how the hell are you going to regulate them? Yeah. He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, PTI is regulated. If somebody wants to know something, they pick up the phone, they call my brother. Who the hell are you going to call?
Yeah.
He goes, well, there's nobody to call. Okay, how do you regulate nothing? Who do you call? How do you say... Who do you call to say how many of these things are? What you just said, these wallets that people can't find. If you had an account with PTI, and a lot of listeners do, and if all of a sudden, if you want your statement sent to your house, and the statements start coming back to us, RBC is going to say, hey, find this guy or this lady. Otherwise, in like 6 months, that money's going to the state with your name on it. Because now you're lost. How the hell can you have another whole business where if you put your money in there, now granted it doesn't have your name on it, how is there not a list at the state of Illinois saying, hey, who's ever got this number of Bitcoin, here's 20 grand, it's yours, come claim it. I mean, how can the rules be so different and people still trust it? I mean,
well,
I think
with Bitcoin, I'm not sure about the other cryptos, but with Bitcoin, you put Bitcoin on a USB drive, and then you have your keywords that you use to access it. Now, if that USB device gets lost, that Bitcoin's gone.
Gone to where? What I'm saying is, if you want,
and it's off the networks. It's not on the internet. It's not like digital currency.
I know what I'm saying, but in normal commerce, if Hal walks into a bank, plunks down $8,000, opens up an account, and gives
money's traceable. But Bitcoin, when you put it in a USB device, it's not traceable.
Okay, my point is when you go into the bank and you put in there, my name's Hal Snower, and where did the Munsters live? Was it something 1111 Mockingham Way or something, whatever the street was? You put that down, you go hiking tomorrow, and all of a sudden you fall off a cliff and you never heard from again. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
In 3 months, that money is sitting with the state of Illinois under Hal Snower with the address you've got there. It's yours, come get it. Now, how the hell can somebody have an entire operation where you don't follow any of those rules?
Yeah.
Yet they do, right?
Well, I think what Bitcoin is, it's like what existed in the United States before the banking system pushed people into banks. Before the banking system, before the Federal Reserve, a lot of people put their money in coffee cans and clay walls. The book The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck is about a guy from China who saves all of his money by storing the clay walls of his house. And that's what people did before the Federal Reserve and other central banks kind of like forced people through devaluation, through inflation, to move their account balances from their clay walls and their coffee cans into a local bank.
Well, you sure as hell.
And that's what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is basically people are putting the money in coffee cans and burying it in the backyard.
Well, I mean,
they're using credit cards. I'm sure a lot of people may not
live 50 years to see it, but I guarantee you, somebody's going to be able to find a way that if Hal's got $20,000 sitting there and it's the year 2070, somebody's going to find Hal's $20,000.
Well, if it was on a USB thumb drive, and that USB thumb drive is under 3 tons of landfill, I think they're going to have a hard time.
There's some system someplace. The money's there. How could it be gone?
The Bitcoin is on a. It's in memory. It's in a memory that's.
I know, but somebody somewhere has to know. Because if you went back in to get your $20,000, it has to know it's yours and it has to send it to you, right? So it's there,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's hidden in some. It's in some landfill in some coffee can, man.
God. So, hey, what's going on with the education stuff? I just had a dinner the other night where we bumped into some guy at the eating dinner, and I don't know what planet he was from. Said something about if Trump can just get rid of this idiot Powell and lower his interest rates like he wants to, we're going to do so well. The economy's going to be better than it ever has before. Why do people believe this stuff? Is there some sort of there need to be like another 1,000 Hal Snars teaching economic classes or what?
Well, I think the things that I like about what's coming out of the administration is all the peace deals he's making. He's making peace with Congo and.
Oh, by the way, I could have sent you something yesterday. All these 7 wars he claims he stopped.
Yeah,
it's all BS. I mean,
I think peace in Ukraine and Russia. I think
if he pulls this off, my hat's off to him.
Yeah. I just think with his Abraham Accords and trying to end these conflicts, I mean, because the Department of Defense and the CIA, I mean, they want war. They need war. And a lot of these politicians love war. You can't make any money when bombs and bullets are sitting on shelves in the Pentagon.
Well, I mean, when you talk,
to come off the shelves. But they can only come off the shelves if there's war everywhere.
But
so
When you talk about these wars, though, Hal, there are areas of the world. Matter of fact, I went through the list yesterday of the 6 wars he claims he stopped. They're all in these areas. There may be some sort of a ceasefire, maybe not.
Yeah.
There are areas where there's all kinds of people, nobody working. I mean, nobody's got any money. It's these are areas of the world, and I can't.
Well, nobody's working because they've had war for 30 years in the Congo.
I'm saying when you have areas where the unemployment rate from 18 to 35 year old males is like 60, I think you got a problem.
Yeah. Well, Gaza. I mean, I remember we talking about this. Right after Hamas went into Israel, Gaza had 40-50% unemployment.
Yeah.
And property rights aren't protected there. So
right.
If property rights aren't protected there, who's going to invest? Who's going to build a hotel? Who's going to build a factory? Who's going to open up a gas station if property rights aren't being protected?
So I'm saying the idea that you're going to have problems out of there is not the fact that they would elect a Hamas doesn't surprise me. When you look at Germany in the 20s, I mean, the only thing you didn't know was the name of the guy that was going to come up, and it ended up being Hitler, but it was going to be somebody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It just, the Weimar Republic formed that, and yet so many people made out like a bandit in that inflationary spiral. All the people who had farms got them paid off, all the people who had buildings got them paid off, and I'll bet those people are still big shooters in Germany today, those families, right? They benefited from that. Just like today, you're never going to take the top 50 families that made money on all this stuff, you're never going to bounce them. 100 years from now, they're still going to be running this country if we don't have some kind of huge resolution or something.
Yeah, I agree with that because that's what government does. Government is marshaled to in a way that protects these very wealthy people. They protect these wealthy people against... Now, it doesn't work all the time. I mean, there's a lot of churn in commerce, but for the most part, I think what happens is government is used to create monopoly power, to cartelize industries, and keep out competitors. That's what government's purpose is. I just built this Turgot model. Turgot was fascinating. I mean, he was supposed to be... his dad envisioned him being the head of a monastery, and so the guy was really well versed in scripture, and he understood why coveting is bad, because coveting leads to consumerism, and if you don't have income, it leads to debt, and then if you're piling in debt, you can't sow, and sowing seeds is a metaphor for investment. So I think all that training he got in the Bible inspired his economics or his way of thinking. And he was basically a Murray Rothbard, a libertarian, working for the King of France at the time. And the King of France was pretty, he had things pretty centralized. And so Turgot had to be very careful about how he explained things and how he advocated for certain things. Otherwise, he might lose his head. So Turgot is just a fascinating guy. And his model of savings is so far advanced for the time. I mean, him and Cantillon should be considered the fathers of economics. And Adam Smith, man, after reading through and analyzing what Turgot and Cantillon were formalizing before Adam Smith, it's just stark.
Yeah, but you don't.
I think Adam needs to be in the back seat.
Well, you don't need to, if you, unfortunately, or fortunately, they had Latin in my high school, Al, because I was pretty awful at all the languages, including English, as everybody listens knows. I took 4 years of Latin, and since I never got any good at Latin, I was pretty good at Roman history, and even then, you knew about the dole. You know, the dole was the.
Oh yeah, you knew about price controls too.
Yeah, you know about
you knew the effects of price controls.
You know the devaluing your currency. Yeah. You know what happens when your people are no longer in the army and you rent other people to fight for you. How this goes from economics to politics to whatever.
Yeah.
And it never changes.
Yeah.
You know, back.
Well, Babylon experimented with price controls, and they understood the consequences of price controls. When you set a price on barley, and times are good and the weather is conducive to growing barley, the supply for barley is really, really high and the price goes low, right? And when you impose a price control and supply is high, the market price is below the government's price. And then when the weather is not very great, supply is very low and the market price is above the government's price.
Yeah, but the game never changes. By the way, one thing about never changing. What do you say we go to break and then we'll talk about it more when we come back. S&P futures down one, NASDAQ futures down 25, down a little bit, but not much. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures down one, down a buck, Chuck. NASDAQ futures down 22. So not much going on here this morning so far, just like yesterday. Because we're waiting for Jackson Hole and nothing ever happens. Like, it's just kind of crazy. DAX up 68.2%, FTSE up 30. Wait a minute, 0.3% on the DAX, 0.3% on the FTSE, 0.9% up 72 on the CAC around. So a little bit bullish over there. Asia, which has been on a tear since they're putting money in the system. Not so much today, but not down very much either. Nikkei's only down 168.4. Hang Seng, which has really been flying, down 53.2, Shanghai down 70 cents. We'll call that one flat. As all the people on CNBC now are saying, buy Chinese stocks. I don't know about that. Bonds, 10-year down 2 basis points, 4.32. The Bund down 1 basis point, 2.76. Oil down 64 cents, 62.78. Cannot get out of its own way. It's another 1%. Brent down 64 cents, 65.96. As our friend Greg Pappas says, there's a lot of action in the crack spread, where the heating oil versus natural versus gasoline is going back and forth, but the oil itself is in. Gold up 530, 33.83, still can't get back over 3,400. Was trying yesterday and did not make it. Silver up a dime, 38.13. Foreign exchange, dollar dithers, whatever that means. Euros at 116.7, so kind of in the high part of the mid range of the last few months. British pound 135, same place, high part of the mid range. We've got crypto, which is down yesterday. It's down another 8.15 today, 115, 536 after making a 120,000 high a couple days ago. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports? Then there's the Cubs. Yuck.
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:39 a.m. here in Chicago, 73 degrees right now with a high of 78. Not as warm, but humid with more clouds than sun tonight. Humid with thickening clouds as well, low of 70 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 83 degrees right now with 110 degrees. Hot with sunshine. And a few clouds. Tonight will be partly cloudy and very warm with a low of 90 degrees. Traffic in Chicago is not looking too good right now. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe is 44 minutes. We're looking at 60 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 55 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 33 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th. And lastly, 15 minutes. Inbound Stevenson from turning 4 to the Dan Ryan. NFL preseason, the Bears won. Bears blank. Bills 38-0 last week, and Cardinals lose to Broncos 7-27. This Friday, we have Bears at Chiefs at 7:20 p.m., and the Saturday following that, Raiders at Cardinals. MLB, the Cubs lose to Brewers 7-0 yesterday, and White Sox beat Braves 13-9. Diamondbacks also lose to Guardians 1-3, and today we have a Cubs-Brewers doubleheader, both in Chicago at 1:20 p.m. and at 7:05 p.m. Then we also have White Sox at Braves 6:15 p.m. and Guardians at Diamondbacks 8:40 p.m. Back to you guys.
So, Hal, just as a quick aside for Stocks and Jacks, the Cubs, when I had my season tickets or shared season tickets, they're actually in Big Don's name, and I bought half the season from him. The Tribune, you wouldn't consider that as a philanthropic organization, but if you had a ticket for, say, a Tuesday, and the Tuesday got rained out, you got your money back for the date because they lost the date, right? You know, the operative didn't go on. If you chose to buy a ticket for the makeup game, if it wasn't the old-style doubleheader, you could do that, but you didn't have to because you lost the date. Well, now, we thank you, sir, may I have another as you're bending over. They had a date. It was a rainout when the Brewers were here the first time, right? So yesterday was one of those split doubleheaders. I'm thinking maybe the first game was a night game, but I'm not positive. But say it was. That ticket is now good for yesterday at 1 o'clock. So now if you have business people, say you have a skybox and you filled it up with 12 people, you can't assume that those people can now make it at 1 in the afternoon. I mean, so there's a game yesterday at 1 in the afternoon. That's the makeup game. If you go to that, you have to leave the stadium for 2 hours and do God knows what, and come back again at 7:05 for a totally separate event. Well, the Cubs get their ass kicked in the first game. Then they decide that the second game, it's going to rain too much. So now, you're bleep out of luck on the second game. The makeup for that game, now if I invited you and all the rest of the people from Stocks and Jocks, if I had a skybox, that's now today at 1:05. And if I can't come today, I don't get any money back or anything. God bless. How do people put up with this crap?
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. I mean, if that happened to me once, I'd probably say, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm out. Yeah.
I don't know what...
My money is my money, and if you're going to play games like that and not deliver a product that I paid for, then I'm out, and you won't see me again.
Well, they're so far into... These season tickets are mostly all corporate. There's some people, and other people who split them up, okay? There's people that buy them, and there's 8 people that each get 10 games or something, which is the only way. So essentially, they have wholesale groups, for lack of a better term, right? And then there's companies that say, I'm buying a skybox in case I need it. But they had a skybox at Sox Park at Mesro didn't. We were there, we were invited a couple times, but it is a full-time job for somebody to manage a skybox. And you'd say, what the hell is he talking about? You're talking about 80 games, which with either 12 to 15 tickets, you're going to have to make sure that your people, they're not just bringing their kids, they're bringing business people, all your salesmen, all your people are going to get it on a certain night. You're going to want the names of the people they're bringing. Are they potential business people? Are they current clients? To actually manage that for 80 nights is a big deal. It's a real big deal to do it properly. Where everybody says, what are you talking about? Just invite a few people. That doesn't work if 80 times, does it? I mean, it is, if somebody has a skybox, you have to make absolutely sure that is managed, because it's a massive investment. Just saying. I mean, nothing's easy in this world, but the idea that you lose the date, and it was a Friday night, and you had all these people coming, don't worry. We're going to make it up at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday in September, and you go... Well, that's cool.
And they're not in Chicago then. They're home.
Yeah.
They're out of town. They're out of state.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, it could be from anywhere. But the last part of what Kenny was talking about is the new mayor of New York. Well, yeah. Not mayor. The guy running for mayor that may win. He's 31 years old. But I've been talking for a bit more with Kevin. I haven't really broached the subject with you. Listeners, I mean, this is not necessarily my politics or anything, but what I've observed and kind of what I feel. When I was in, Dr. J and I, John Najarian, and we brought another guy with us, we were over in Europe in 1991 doing seminars at a couple of banks and meeting a lot of people and doing stuff. And it was, boy, talk about different world, hell. The banks own most of the stock.
Yeah, they're different than American banks. Yeah.
Well, I mean, here... If J.P. Morgan owns 10,000 shares of GM, that's not considered good capital. Over there, it is. Okay, so that's here. You don't have that phenomenon of banks owning companies, which is, I think, a really good thing. But over there, that's not the way it was. So people are all the option traders are employees of a bank, and they're trading options. They're making markets and options. And stacked the bank owns.
Wow.
I mean, it was, and everybody you talk to, and these people were all late 20s, 30, early 30s. There was not a hint of entrepreneurial. We can't go anywhere. Only the old people have the money. If you're in a law firm, you don't become a partner until you're 50. You don't make any money until you're 40. I mean, all these guys were sharing apartments, and when they weren't 22. They were, you know, they were older, and just. It wasn't like a despair, because there was a... As a matter of fact, me being the goofball that I am, we went to this big fair in Frankfurt. It's on a street. Of course, the streets in Germany are... You can eat off the pavement, right? And everybody's drinking beer, and no such thing as a paper cup there. You got your glass and everything. And all of a sudden, we're sitting with a few of the ladies and a couple of the guys, and I see these, you know, four or five young women with older dudes. And I go, boy, I like the fact that this is a family festival. And she goes, what are you talking about? And I said, well, all these guys walking along with their daughters. And she looks me right in the eye and she goes, German women like guys with money, and in Germany the only people with money are the old guys. What's your problem? Like, okay then. I mean, even if it's true, you wouldn't really get a lady here to just say that to you, even if they felt it. I mean, what are you talking about? Well, German girls like people with money, and the old guys got the money. What's the problem? And I'm like, well, I guess there's no problem. I had no argument today. But when I came back, and I just economically, hell, I almost felt like I needed a shower when I got back here.
Yeah.
It was 4 or 5 companies. In every, maybe not even, 2, 3, 4, 5 companies in every industry with their nose right up the ass of government. And I said, and all these banks had all this power, they had all this money, and you couldn't even go in the boardroom on that floor if you were just a regular person. And I go, God, I hope we're never going to get like that. Hell, we're there. And I don't see how you ever, unless they really, really bleep up. And I don't want them to fall, because I know a lot of people and a lot of our clients got stuck. As long as Apple can go to the White House and get a deal that nobody else can get, it reminds me of fascist Germany. I mean, it's not my idea of a market. Right in the loop here, there used to be 1,500, 2,000 people. They traded every day on their own. Now there's nobody. Everybody works for somebody else. I'm not saying it's despair. I mean, people make a decent living, and it's, you know, the rest of the world be jealous. But all the guys, we will stop at our table, you know, we get a couple of guys that are 27, 28, 25, stop. They're working for a regulatory, they're all working for FINRA or some damn place, OCC. Man, Chief, I don't see myself having any fun like you did when you came down here. There's no chance I'm never going to get a raise. I'm never going to get another job. I'm never going to be a VP of OCC or the SIBO. They're in Kansas City now, for God's sake. Well, they got their offices here. But there's none of that feeling like when I was young. And so it doesn't surprise me that the people in New York, the young people, get despaired enough to say, "Look, let's put somebody else up there. The other guys aren't doing us any favors."
Well, the problem with his solution is going to make it worse, not better.
I get all that, and you know my knowledge on it, my views on it.
The people who are supporting him, they want a different set of policies. They don't want his policies.
I get that.
His policies are going to make the thing even worse. So
I read something.
Understand what they're thinking.
You read some really interesting stuff, and I love it when you tell us about it. I read an economic paper. I don't know how long ago it was. Long time. When a guy says, in most societies, when people get the help of government or something, 5% of the people are going to steal all the money from the other 95% of the people. And the guy says, it's actually fairly vibrant. You know, it's
well, you got to look at COVID. I mean,
it's vibrant. So he goes, the job of government is to take the money from the 5%, somehow sprinkle it back down again so they can do it all over again. I'm reading this thing, I'm going, God, this guy's a moron. And then all of a sudden I'm sitting around, you know, he might not be all wrong. There's always something partially right in everything you even disagree with, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
But how do you turn this bus around? Our young people don't feel that the world is their oyster. And when I was young, everybody I knew, even if we didn't have a squad, if two people were living in the same apartment, you felt the next year you were going to kick some ass. And I don't see that attitude in any of these people now. And it troubles me.
Well, there are two base camps in the United States. And they've been fighting over this for hundreds of years. And there's the camp that wants to make us Europe. And there's the camp that wants to keep us free. And I'm the camp that wants to keep us free.
Oh, you and I are on, you know, I'm on that page, boy.
Yeah. The freest society, the society that is the freest, is going to be the society that continues to dominate the world and grow and advance technology. It's going to be the best for all Americans. So it's the free society. The society is free of all these rules and regulations, these European-style rules and regulations that create the environment where you have to have permission to do everything, where your market power is determined by government action. And that's been the case for Europe for centuries. The word liberty in continental Europe has a different meaning than it does maybe in the UK and the United States.
It means you can go to the bar. That's about it. You go to the bar. And you can find your own girlfriend. That's about it. Yeah. That's our idea.
Well, the word liberty in continental Europe is basically when people in a country say we're free, we're liberated, we have liberty, that means they're free from another state running their state.
Yeah.
In the United States, liberty means I'm free from, I'm free to make decisions. I'm free to pursue my passions from government. That's what liberty means in the United States. And so there's these two camps, one that wants to make us more Europe and one that wants to be free. And I'm on the side of freedom, and that's what we need. We need more freedom and less government creating monopolies, like, you know, all these people on the
hell,
left.
Hell, I want 1,500 right? traders. I don't want five.
Yeah. These people who are so anti-monopoly are so for monopoly. It's really shocking because what is the banking system? The banking system in the United States is one giant monopoly. These big, large banks own the Federal Reserve. They can have the Federal Reserve print money for them. So we have a huge monopoly problem, and it's not created by, it's not a result of market failures. Okay. It's a result of government failures.
Okay, when you say that, and I'm with you, and I agree with you. Except, yeah. What is you're in Virginia, right? Or are you in North Carolina?
North Carolina.
Now, what is the status of the banks there? Where is North Carolina's history regarding branch banking and things like that?
Oh, it's probably like most states. Where,
well, I'm saying because Illinois was the last state to allow branch banking, and there are the big banks here, you know, they do their thing, and they're way too big. I get that part, but I could throw a 1,000-yard rope around my office, and there's got to be 7 independent banks.
Yeah,
maybe 5. You can still, in anywhere here, Audrey's in Orland, there's probably 4 independent banks in Orland. But Illinois is, I think, very unique in that regard. I know a couple people that have stuff at Citi or somebody. Everybody else
is very. From what I can tell, it sounds a lot like the Canadian banking system. The Canadian banking system was very, very Scottish. The Scots had like a free banking system where, you know, people could open up whatever they wanted to, right? There was a lot less regulation. And when we say free banking, what I mean by free banking is there is no FDIC, there is no lender of last resort, and a bank's got to be really careful.
Well, you're not going to have no FDIC after the Depression. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, but a free banking system is not one where there's FDIC and Freddie and Fannie and the Federal Reserve. That is the opposite of a free banking
system. Yeah, but how are you ever going to tell as a... I mean, I'm not a big regulatory dude, but if you didn't have an FDIC or people doing some sort of bank examining, how the hell would you know if they have any money when you put your money in there? They're not going to tell you.
Well, I mean, it's no different than Walmart. Walmart has food on the shelves. Why? Because the most brutal regulator of all time are consumers. Right now, consumers in our heavily regulated, heavily cartelized, monopolized banking system, they pick a bank based on what the ATM experience is like. It's got a roof over it so I don't get rained on. How people choose banks today.
I'm not so big, as you know, on regulation, but I also know when I was a Ute, did he say Ute? That if your mother sent you out to buy an extension cord and you brought one back that didn't have UL on it, they sent you back with it. I mean, somebody somewhere, if you're going to drop $20,000 in a bank, you don't look to see the balance sheet and the loan portfolio. I mean,
we don't in the world we live in. But I mean, but if we lived in a different world, we would.
But I mean, if there was no FDIC, there would be somebody who says, I will approve this bank and I'll do it. It'll be an accounting firm. It'll be somebody. It's not ma and pa walking in there and saying, let me look at your loan portfolio.
Well, because, Tom, we grew up in that world. We grew up in a world, the only world that we observed is the world we were living in. We don't understand how much better it can be in a different universe. I watched this show called, I think, Dark something on Apple TV. It's Joel Edgerton. He stars in it as a scientist who invents a box. When you enter it, you can you have it's basically a doorway to infinite many versions of the world that you live in. And so I'd like to go into that box, open the door, and enter the United States where there's a free banking system. And if a bank wants to make a 30-year loan, they have to issue 30-year treasury or time deposits in the same amount. And that's the world I would like to see.
Well,
banking is more of a warehouse instead of what we have now, a money printing machine.
Well, I would my view of the savings and loans back in the day, and
what did the Fed do with the savings loans? It crushed it into.
I'm saying okay. What I'm trying to. It's always hard for my guests on the show. It's always hard to agree with them. It's what you guys are. I would have changed the savings and loans going back to those days. I would have said okay. Not only can you put your passbook money in here, but we're going to take. We're going to have A mortgages, B mortgages, C mortgages, you know, and we're going to have a neighborhood of, you know, whatever, 5-10 square miles, and we're going to put our best mortgages in this package, and the package is going to be a 30-year bond, and people in the neighborhood or whoever could come in and buy a slice of that, right, instead of, which is essentially what Fannie and Freddie do, but why couldn't it have been done locally, where walk in, I'm saving, you know, $2,000 from last week. I got a big bonus check. I'm going to put $500 in my passbook. And by the way, the other $1,500, I'm going to invest in a 30-year bond that's backed by these 50 mortgages. We could have done that, which is exactly what you're saying, right?
Well, what I'm saying is if you want to make $1 million, if you're a banker, you want to make $1 million loan.
But that's a 30-year obligation matched up with a 30-year bond, right?
Exactly. You do that in the finance world. You don't do that in banking. In banking, you make a loan out of callable loans known as checking accounts. So you make a 30-year loan, you're at any moment in time, the money that's backing those 30-year loans can be pulled out of the bank.
Well, it can't if it's a bond you sold, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So in the world I envision,
you didn't like my idea.
If a bank wants to make a 30-year loan for $1 million, the principal's $1 million, they would want to when there's no FDIC, when there's no lender of last resort, they'd want to encourage people to deposit money into a time deposit of the same maturity.
That's what I just said.
The same principal.
That's what I just said.
That's the banking system that I would prefer.
That's what I just said. Say if the bank bundled 100 mortgages, the bank would hold 20% of it or 15, and the other people get a chance to buy on the other. This is a 7% mortgage. For 30 years, I would have cut it down maybe to 25 or 20, but still.
But the FDIC and the lender of last resort creates all kinds of moral hazards. Bankers can be not as careful with people's money.
They don't, because no bank wants to go under. They don't cover you.
Well, no bank wants to go under, but what happens is you can't. When a young kid from a very wealthy family is given everything. He's given allowance, you know, cars are purchased for him. You create all kinds of moral hazards in there. When you're a government and you bail out people for making bad decisions, how good a person the person is, you're going to create moral hazards.
I'm going to push back a little. We only got a minute, but the mistake you're making here, in my opinion, is if you and I. By the way, I did some work on this because one of the guys wanted to buy a bank on the south side, so I did some of the numbers for him. You could buy, and it actually was at a Sox game one night, talking. You and I could have started a bank with probably $1.5-2 million. This is 20 years ago. Now we could probably do it with $5 million, by the way, in Illinois. But say it was $2 million. You and I both write a check for $2 million. We open up a storefront near the train station, like, by the way, Beverly Bank did on the south side, and so did Evergreen Bank. When somebody else bought them, they took the name, went down the block. We could do that, and all of a sudden we're taking deposits from people, and we're probably going to invest them in treasuries, just make a little bit. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have enough where maybe we give out some car loans or do something, or maybe we have a credit card where we do a little bit of it, not the whole number. But at some point, the money in there is ours. The fact that the people come in and make a deposit, they are made feel good by FDIC. But still, if you and I make some clunk loan and we lose $2 million, it's our $2 million. So it's they're not backing us. They're just backing the depositors.
What I'm saying though is, what I'm trying to say is, when you have all these backstops.
Yeah, but we don't have the backstop as the owners. It's our dough. We have no backstop.
People don't have to be as careful as they would have been otherwise. Yeah. If there's no FDIC and there's no lender of the last resort, you're going to be really careful with your deposit.
Okay, what I'm saying is the equity is ours. If we lose, we lose. The FDIC is not floating us. They're floating a depositor.
Yeah, I see a bank. See, I just see a bank as no different than a parking garage. When somebody deposits money into the bank, it should be like parking your car in the bank. That's your money. It's your car.
Well, that's not.
And the way the banking system works is that the bank takes ownership of the money. They take ownership of the car, and they lend your car out to people. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
Well,
I think a bank should be a warehouse.
Somebody, we got a dash, but they're in this country and every country. There's people that have excess cash that don't know what to do with it. When I say don't know what to do with it,
has an excess car, they park in a parking.
They don't invest. They don't have, and somebody else has people that have all the ideas. And what the bank does is the intermediary. They put those people together. And if you don't have that, you have a combination of that, the markets, the banks. Those are the people, you know, some of your angel investing funds. There's all kinds of people that, you know. If you won the lottery tomorrow, $5 billion, you have $5 billion. Unless you plan on building a college on your own or something, you don't know what to do. I mean, how the hell are you going to invest? Well, there's probably a bunch of people.
I'm saying, Tom, is a person who parks a car in a parking garage.
Yeah. Okay,
that car stays there unless the person. Gives.
I know, but nobody's gonna want that bank.
I know, but this is how it works though. If the bank wants to make a loan from my money. That's basically in a safety deposit box. It has to provide me with.
By the way, if you're in a safety deposit box, they can't lend it. You know that.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. The banking should be right. If they want me,
well, I'm not going to invest in your bank. You're not going to make any money.
But it won't make money in the.
But how do you pay interest if you don't have a loan?
What I'm saying though is, the money is parked in the bank. It's in a safe, and if the bank wants to make a loan with my money. It's got to provide me with a high enough interest rate for me to convert it into a time deposit.
All right, well,
and that kind of banking is going to be
How about to be continued next week?
You won't need all these government protections.
How about to be continued next week? We also want to hear how you're coming on your class, History and Economic Thought. S&P Futures down 5, NASDAQ Futures down 49. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. Oh.
That's all, folks.